It's time for the all-new Gervie's Law, cross-examining the ages with your host, Alan Gervie, and introducing your co-host, Michelle Lobato. Alan is the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan Gervie & Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm which has represented injured workers for over 40 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervie.
Hi, I am Alan Gervie, and this is Gervie's Law. It is so nice to be back on the air. We have been off the air for some time now, and we appreciate all the support while we were off the air. But I guess we weren't the only show that ABC pulled off the air, suspended. I'm here to say that I'm sorry if I offended anyone. I'm sorry. I believe in freedom of speech. I believe that I should be able to speak the truth, my words, and not be handcuffed by the government or anyone else. And, you know, truthfully, I don't think what I have said has been that offensive. But maybe I should. Jimmy Kimmel got 6 million people watching his show the other night, and another 26 million on YouTube. So maybe that's a really good way to increase the ratings. But I will tell you that I don't understand how you can make a decision to take someone off the air, like me, and then to bring them back. Like, where are the principles? If you are going to take someone off the air, you'd think that you put some thought into that decision, but didn't just basically give in to public opinion. But that's not how our world works. And, you know, we're going to talk the truth here on Gervie's Law. And I wanted to introduce, for the younger generation, I have a new co-host, a TikTok star, who will be co-hosting with me, Michelle Lobato. Welcome to Gervie's Law.
Hi, thanks for that lovely introduction. I'm here to bring a fresh perspective. You know, we got to get some Generation Z energy.
I don't know about that. I mean, you were late for the show today. It's kind of representative of what your generation is like. You know, we talk about people years ago who took responsibility seriously.
You know what? That is all old thinking. The whole paying your dues, working in office 5 days a week. That is old news. You know, you got to get with the times. As long as the job gets done, that's what matters. And I'm here today.
Well, you are here, and we are welcoming you. We're happy you're here. And we have a lot to talk about today on Gervie's Law. And I will tell you that after a prolonged hiatus, there is no more important issue to talk about than preventing harm in our society, but preserving freedom of speech. What a balance. How difficult can we focus on prevention of harm and preserving the freedom of speech? It's a fine line. We're going to address it today. And who better to address that all-encompassing issue with than one of the world's best-known lawyers, if not the world's best-known lawyer, former Harvard Law professor, focusing on constitutional law and criminal law, amongst other branches of law. Prolific writer, 57, 58 books, and we're going to talk about his latest. Commentator, legal analyst, who's represented some very well-known people. We are pleased to welcome Alan Dershowitz to Gervie's Law. Welcome back, Alan. So nice to have you.
Well, thanks. Nothing could be more important than how to strike the balance. You know, I have a letter on my wall, a handwritten letter from Thomas Jefferson on the 25th anniversary of the Declaration. He's sitting in his office and writing to somebody who says, you know, we ought to suppress speech if it's going to cause harm. And Jefferson writes and says, no, we have to wait until a crime is committed. People have the right to say what they want to say, and it could be dangerous, but we've opted for a society in which we favor a free speech, even if it poses some dangers, rather than giving the government the power to censor. But of course, it's not only the government that censors. You know, ABC big shots putting Kimmel back on. I'm still censored on ABC. I can't go on ABC.
And what
I can't
about
go on CNN.
Alan,
they banned me because I defended Donald Trump.
And what about the New York Times? You know, the first thing when you write a book, you go to New York Times to see the review. But what happened with this book that the New York Times won't even respect your 56 other books?
Well, I've been on the New York Times bestseller list more than any law professor in history, and I've written more books than any law professor in history. But the Times canceled me the minute I defended Donald Trump. So since that moment, I've been censored. I've been canceled. I've never had a single review. I've never had a book on the bestseller list, even though I've had the numbers to justify the bestseller. The Times just decided to cancel me. CNN decided to cancel me. MSNBC decided to cancel me. And all these media talk so much about free speech, and they themselves exercise partisan censorship if they don't agree with who you represent. I've been banned by my local library on Martha's Vineyard. I've been banned by my local synagogue, Temple Emmanuel, in New York because I defended Donald Trump. And, you know, censorship is pervasive. The story about Kimmel is interesting, but it's a one-off. We're seeing censorship all over the place, mostly private censorship, but some of it is obviously in response to threats by the government as well.
You know, I want to get to that, but before I do, since you brought it up, tell me the difference between Congressman Ilhan Omar's speech and Charlie Kirk's speech. You are someone who obviously is aware of what both of them say. Is one right and one not? Or are they both right? Where do we cross the line to hate speech versus freedom of speech?
Well, I don't think Kimmel's was hate speech. I think it was just stupid, not funny, insensitive, and not deserving of 6 million viewers. Ilhan Omar is a racist, a bigot, an anti-Semite, somebody who specializes in hate speech, but she has congressional immunity, so she can't get fired. She could get fired, but her voters love her because many of her voters support her point of view. But members of Congress do have immunity under the Constitution for anything they say on the floor of the Congress, even if it's libelous or deliberately, even with malice libelous. They have total immunity, unlike the New York Times, which has immunity unless you can prove that what they said with malice.
And what about Charlie Kirk?
Charlie Kirk really has no immunity. He said what he said. I mean, he was, you know, somebody who wanted very much to encourage debate in America. I was on his show a number of times. He was a terrific talk show host because you never knew what his views were. He was interested in getting at your views and contradicting them. He was a contrarian, and we need more of that. You know, today at Harvard University, they couldn't have the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Half the students wouldn't want to hear Lincoln. Half the students want to hear Douglas. Debate is dead at many American universities today. Instead, we see violence. We see encampments. We see at the University of Syracuse yesterday, two students throwing pork at a Jewish kosher Rosh Hashanah dinner. And, you know, now they've been arrested for hate crimes. Now, interesting question. Whether it's protected speech to throw pork at a kosher dinner. Well, it's trespassing because they trespassed on the premises of the Jewish fraternity that they threw the pork at. But normally it would be expressive free speech.
Alan, can I ask you,
does
this scare you in speaking out? I mean, you talk about such controversial issues. Is there any sense of fear when you're publishing these or speaking out on these issues?
No, I don't personally have any fear. I've been doing this now. You know, I'm 87 years old. I'm not worth taking a shot at and wasting a bullet. I fear for other people. You know, I fear for your generation that isn't permitted to speak on college campuses if they have contrary views. If you try to walk through one of those encampments, the Harvard encampment, the Columbia encampment, wearing a Star of David, you could be killed. You could literally be killed. You certainly will be assaulted.
Jeez, that's horrible.
I wore a T-shirt on Martha's Vineyard, where I've been going for 55 years since I defended Ted Kennedy. I wore a T-shirt saying "Proud American Zionist," and the man who sells the pierogi at the farmer's market refused to sell me because he doesn't agree with my views or who I represented. Interesting, because that happened the other day with Clerk Memorial. Somebody tried to get a poster printed of a memorial for Kirk, and they refused to print the poster. And the Justice Department is now going to be investigating whether or not this company has the right to refuse to make posters based on political opposition to what's in the poster. It's an interesting variation on the cake case that went to the Supreme Court, where a baker refused to bake a cake for a gay couple celebrating their marriage.
Yeah, we actually had the attorney for the couple on our show several years ago, and it begged so many important questions. And one of them that I want to give you, Alan, a quote, and I'm not going to tell you who it's from, but maybe you'll recognize it, maybe you won't. "Whether you think I am the devil or not, the justice system has to be examined." Who said that?
I could have said it. Anybody could have said it, but it's a great quote. It reminds me of a quote from A Man for All Seasons. You know, would you give the devil his due? And the answer is yes, because if the devil doesn't get due process, nobody else will.
And that's right. Now, I'm going to tell you who said it, and I think you're going to have something to say about it. That was said by Keith Raniere.
Yeah, well, Keith Raniere is right. And Keith Raniere, you know, is in prison now for the rest of his life for doing nothing that appears to me to be in any way criminal. They got him on the basis of false evidence. They manufactured a date on a photograph to create the impression that he photographed an underage girl nude, when in fact the evidence strongly suggests that she was well above the age of consent and that she consented. And they put him in jail for that, and a number of other people pleaded guilty as the result of that distortion of the evidence. And now the judge refuses to give us a hearing, an evidentiary hearing. We have, I'm one of his lawyers, we have six or seven, maybe even more, former FBI and law enforcement experts who are prepared to testify that this was a frame-up. And at the very least, the judge ought to take a look and see, hear the evidence. The judge says, no, I'm not interested. I'm just not interested. No, too late. We can't do anything about it. Well, fortunately, under our system of checks and balances, you can do something about it. You can go to the president and seek a commutation or a pardon. You can go to the appellate courts. And, you know, we're doing all of the above because this is a man in jail for the rest of his life based on a fake picture.
You know, this has been such an important issue to you personally, as well as obviously many others. When we talk about government's acts of misconduct, how does that impact the bigger picture? Because Keith Raniere is only a microcosm compared to what, for instance, and we're going to talk about your new book, The Preventative State, The Challenge of Preventing Serious Harm While Preserving Essential Liberty. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. But tell us how the Keith Raniere case is representative of such a bigger issue.
Well, I have on my wall, and it isn't the Jefferson letter, I have the original newspaper account of Emile Zola protesting the frame-up of Dreyfus, which one of the major cases in world history of a frame-up. He was a Jewish guy in the French military, and they absolutely framed him, sent him to Devil's Island, ultimately admitted it was a frame-up. Somebody else did it. We know who did it. We know the name of the guy who did it. His name was Esterhazy. But he spent years and years and years on Devil's Island, came close to dying as a result of a government frame-up. The military was anti-Semitic, and they wanted to blame spying on some a Jewish officer. And that was the first big, big case involving, you know, government frame-ups and forged and false evidence. And, you know, I'm not saying Raniere is the Dreyfus case, but I am saying that once you begin allowing false evidence and not calling for a hearing, an evidentiary hearing at which both sides are presented, you're on a really deep slippery slope toward the Dreyfus case.
You know, one of your most provocative points that you mention in the book is that prevention often requires surveillance. How much intrusion into personal privacy is ever justified to stop a potential threat that hasn't yet materialized?
Well, that's a question for your generation. And in my book, I argue that your generation doesn't have the same respect for privacy that my generation. Now, I may be overgeneralizing, but, you know, your generation, so many people put so much of their private life in public
we
on
do.
The internet.
We do. I do. Yeah. I do vlogs on TikTok where I show people, I live in LA. I do this in my day. Do that.
Yeah, that's okay because you decide to do that. But then people are sending, naked pictures of themselves and intimate suggestions of what they're doing. And they don't seem to care as much about privacy. Justice Brandeis, one of the greatest justices in history, called the right of privacy the most important right of all, to keep the government out of your business. And that's why surveillance is so dangerous. And, we live in the surveillance state. One of the chapters in my book is called The Surveillance State. And you look at England, where you can't go 20 feet without in public without a camera recording every one of your movements. And now they're moving toward also having sound. And so conversations are going to be recorded by the government. Now, that's enormously helpful. When the health executive was shot in New York by Mangione, they caught him. Jesse Tisch, my former student, who's the police commissioner of New York, did a phenomenal job of catching him by going through all the films that were taken of the surrounding areas and really being able to present a clear identification, which then led to him being identified sitting in a cafe somewhere. So there's a real good that comes from massive surveillance, but at a very, very high cost. And my generation fought back against that cost. And I'm concerned that your generation may not fight as hard about that cost.
There's an interesting quote that goes, what Orwell failed to predict was that we'd buy the cameras ourselves and that our biggest fear would be that nobody was watching. And I feel like that's very indicative to what you're saying, that my generation does love the press and we love the starlight.
Also, I used to tell my students, I stopped teaching 11 years ago, so this was before the pervasiveness, but I would tell my students, look, you're Harvard students, which means you're news. If you're caught doing something terrible, your hometown newspaper would love nothing more than to say, Harvard Law School student caught urinating on the sidewalk. And so I told my students, don't do that because there are video cameras all over. And your life is no longer your own, is no longer private. Things that you used to think you can do without it being recorded are now being recorded. And so people have to change their attitudes. Now, your generation in a democracy has the right to set its own rules. And as 87-year-old old man, I'm not going to tell your generation how to value various things like expression on the one hand and privacy on the other hand. But I am going to tell you that you pay a cost for it. And it's a cost that you may think is worth paying, but it's a cost. And so in my book, I try very hard to create a new jurisprudence for what I think is a new phenomenon, that is the preventive state. States are no longer waiting for harms in order to react. They're taking preventive action in the environment, in healthcare, in stopping crime. What we're doing now with deporting illegal aliens is designed as crime and harm prevention. What we're doing in suppressing some free speech is designed to be harm prevention. President Trump just today said that the radical left, by insulting ICE workers and et cetera, is causing violence. And there may be some truth to that. On the other hand, do we want to prevent the left from criticizing ICE? Of course not. ICE is, every government institution warrants scrutiny and criticism. So, we have to strike the appropriate balance. That's what I try to do in the preventive state by creating a new jurisprudence for prevention.
Alan, Erwin Chemerinsky, speaking of the left, who's a frequent guest on our show, said,
great guy.
he said about your book, an urgently important book about how to balance the desire to have governments prevent crises with the need to safeguard fundamental freedoms. It's a great statement. It's something I know you believe in. But the real question is, how do we do it? And that's what your book looks at, the preventative state. Yeah, tell us.
But the book is being, you know, canceled as well. I'll give you an example. I sent copies of this book, which is my, I've written 58 books. This is my most important book. I've written more books than any professor in the history of Harvard Law School. And so I sent a copy of this book to every member of the Harvard Law School faculty, every single member. I did not get a single response.
Well, what were you
not
thinking?
Not a
what
single were you, response.
You weren't surprised at that?
I just wanted to see. I really wanted to see. You know, I was there 50 years. I was probably the best known professor at Harvard Law School. Many people wrote to me, said they went to Harvard Law School because I was there. And now I've been retired 10 years, and I can't even get a note. I mean, a one-line note saying, hey, Alan, congratulations on your 58th book, or it's a really good book. Look what Stephen Breyer, the former justice of the Supreme Court, said about it. And look what the former president of Harvard said about it. It's a good book. No, not a single note from the Harvard Law School faculty. It just shows what happens when you're canceled. The Harvard Law School faculty used to love me because I was a liberal Democrat. I defended President Clinton. I defended Ted Kennedy. I defended Democrats. But as soon as I defended Donald Trump, I was no longer acceptable to the Harvard Law School faculty, and they were going to cancel me and my books.
Alan, do you think that the turning pointer, you know, Charlie Kirk's legacy and what he tried to do on campuses will change any of that to open up students' minds to books like yours?
Some. But it will also close more minds. You think a single member of the Harvard Law School faculty cares about this? No, I don't think so. They're busy doing their own thing. They're not involved in these kinds of concerns. So, yeah, it will open up some students' minds. And the one thing about the anti-Semitism and the anti-intellectualism and the anti-conservatism that's on campus is it has stimulated conservatives and Zionists and Christians to become more assertive on campus. Small number, because the admissions committee still controls. And if you say you're a Zionist, or if you say you're a religious Christian, you're not going to get admitted to a lot of universities, a lot of elite universities. But if you say you support Antifa and really love the radical left, you're much more likely to get admitted. So the admissions committees determine the student bodies, and that's why the faculty generates itself. That's why you get, 97% of the Harvard faculty is Democrat? I mean, there's something wrong with that. Democrats aren't any smarter than Republicans. And there's some bias being reflected by these numbers. And, you know, they talk about diversity. What they're talking about diversity, they're talking about skin color. I'm right. Talking about diversity of intellectual views, diversity of opinion, diversity of ideology. We're not getting that on university campuses.
And that's something that has been so lost throughout our society. In fact, the other day I was in front of a judge and he had just become a judge. And I said to him quickly, why did you close your practice and become a judge? And he said, well, I was listening to one of my clients go on. And at some point I couldn't believe the words that came out of my mouth, but I said, and what makes you think I care? And when I heard that,
yeah.
You know, it's just what you're talking about. So many people have their minds made up and, yeah. You know, they don't care. And that's why your book is important, whether you agree with it or not. It needs
to
be.
Try to sell that. Try to persuade that to bookstores. Left-wing bookstores won't carry my book.
You sound so defeatist. I've never heard you sound so defeatist.
No, I'm fighting back. Why I'm on your show is I'm fighting back. The Martha's Vineyard Book Fair, which attracts authors from all over the country. I am the best-selling author in Martha's Vineyard. They invited me every year to speak at the Martha's Vineyard Book Fair until I defended Trump. Now they refuse to allow the people at the Martha's Book Fair to hear my views. That's why I come on your show.
Yeah, I know. I understand. And also you like me too. So that's the other reason. But and by the way, I'm not going to throw pork at you, but I will wish you a Shana Tova. So that's
thank you. You too. You too. And all your listeners, no matter what their religion or faith, let them have a good year.
That's right. Let them have a good year. You know, you talk about defending Trump. Your name also, as we've talked about in the past, has been in the news with Epstein. Does that have any effect on what you're trying to do now?
I don't think so. I think everybody knows that, you know, I was falsely accused and I was able to prove beyond any doubt that I never even heard of the woman who accused me or met her. And she ultimately admitted that she, you know, may have confused me with somebody else. So I've had no problem with the Epstein thing. I want all the Epstein files to be released because they would obviously exculpate me. So I want everything out there. And I don't think there's anything in there that's incriminating of Donald Trump or of any other prominent people or Bill Clinton. You know, there are some people who may have had associations with Epstein after he was convicted. I didn't. My associations with him were completely professional, and they stopped the moment he got out of prison. But others continued. And, you know, so, you know, Bill Gates, for example, continued. Noam Chomsky continued to have a close relationship with him. So, you know, people have to answer those questions. But I don't think the Epstein thing, I think it's all been the Trump thing. We live in such a divided society that if you defended Trump, you must be a Trumpist in every way. I mean, people didn't say that about John Adams when he defended the people accused of the Boston massacre. They knew he was not in favor of the Boston.
But I'll tell you one thing, Alan. Amazon has not canceled you. And if anyone wants to get your book, they can readily get it on Amazon. The Preventative State, The Challenge of Preventing Serious Harm While Preserving Essential Liberty. I want to thank you.
I appreciate that. And if you really want to get even with the New York Times for not doing anything or the cancellations, you know, buy my book on Amazon.
That's right. All right, Alan, thanks for being with us today. Have a good year, and we appreciate it. Good
luck
with everything.
Thank you, Alan. Good luck.
This show is pre-recorded and furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.